Good morning. Welcome to day two of Visioning a Better America conference, a conference of citizens that has been planned for 3 years and was always intended to be held in Congress. But unfortunately, a week or so ago, the Sergeant of Arms of the House of Representatives had to close all congressional rooms to conferences because of the continuing trauma and threat of domestic terrorists from January 6th on. But here we are live streaming, presenting 25 citizens who will talk about their work to make a better America as embodied in our founding documents. Here is the pocket version of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence that most members of Congress and Supreme Court justices carry in their pocket. And you often see them when they're being interviewed on television, as Justice Stephen Breyer did last week when he was interviewed on the PBS NewsHour. He took out this from his pocket to show how dear it was and how he carries it with him. And as it says in the beginning of the Constitution, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. The founders knew that they were not perfect, and they wanted their progeny, future citizens, to make it more perfect. And so we're happy to bring you 25 citizens of our 328 million fellow citizens who have been working to make a better America. And I'm delighted to introduce this morning Dr. Sabine O'Hara, who will speak on the future of food, reconnecting with nature. Dr. O'Hara is a researcher, an educator, a persistent, innovative, and caring person. Dr. O'Hara is a teacher, mentor, researcher, and administrator committed to improving the quality of life and economic opportunity in underserved communities. She holds doctoral and master's degrees in agricultural and environmental economics and leads an innovative PhD program in urban leadership and entrepreneurship at the University of the District of Columbia, UDC, the only exclusively urban land-grant university in the United States. As you know, the Land-Grant Act was signed by Abraham Lincoln, our greatest visionary leader. Previously, she was Dean of the College of Agriculture, Urban Sustainability and Environmental Sciences, and led UDC building a new model for urban agriculture and sustainability for students and residents in a poor neighborhood of DC to create successful careers in the green innovative economy. Dr. O'Hara served as president of Roanoke College in Virginia, provost of Green Mountain College in Vermont, faculty member at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in New York, and executive director of the Council for International Exchange of Students, which administers the Fulbright Scholar Program. I'm delighted to bring you Dr. O'Hara, and please correct me if I mispronounced your first name.
Yeah, it's Sabina. Thank you so much, Sabina, for this thank you so much for this generous introduction. So my name is also a giveaway that I'm a bit of an internationalist. I'm a naturalized United States citizen, originally from Germany, and fell madly in love with an American of Irish descent. So there you have it.
Wonderful. That's America.
That's America. That's the interesting combination of many of our names, isn't it? So thank you so much for putting this conference together. It is really an honor and a pleasure to be here this morning to speak to you about food. And in the introduction you just heard, about the University of the District of Columbia's rich history as both a historically Black college and university and an 1862 land grant. So those of you who are familiar with the history of land grant universities in the United States will know that that was the first group of land grants that was chartered at that time with a distinct mission of not only educating people on campuses, but also to provide capacity building education outside of the walls of the university. And of course, the United States economy, as basically every economy in the world at that time in 1862, the core of the economy was agriculture and food. And so that capacity building mission focused largely on food. And so it is this interesting history that puts the University of the District of Columbia, which is definitely in an urban context, but it has this focus on food and agriculture that comes with the land grant mission. And so apart from being a foodie myself, I just love food and food cultures. But quite apart from that, as a researcher, I am very intrigued with food because it is so important. And so let me highlight why I say that. Food is universal. We all need to eat. There is really no option. It fuels our bodies. It gives us energy. But it also is very personal because we have likes and dislikes about food. Food is also cultural. It expresses who we belong to. I'm sure all of you can come up with some ideas of food immediately when it comes to not only the big festivals like Thanksgiving, for example, where we have certain foods and it's very much part of the American culture. But I'm sure all of you can also think of some more personal food cultures. Since my birthday is in October, my birthday cake was always hazelnut cake, because by then most of fruit in Northern Europe was gone. And so there are certain foods that we associate with times of the years, with seasons, with cultures. Some of us are into spicy food or pickle everything, and some of us like it a little bit milder. So food also connects us with nature. And if you've ever gardened and if you've ever taught a kid to garden, you know what I mean. There is nothing that can replace this feeling in the springtime for me when I'm in the garden the first time and I get my hands dirty and I confess to be a gardener. Don't tell that to the land grant educators. I confess to being a gardener who occasionally takes her shoes off because I love that feeling of the soil. And so, it connects us also to each other, because a lot of times we garden with other people or for other people. We grow food for our own consumption, but we also share food. And on a more technical side, food connects us with a number of other sectors of the economy. It's not just agriculture that has to do with food in terms of the economy, but it's the tractor makers, the fertilizer makers, the pesticide makers, it's the restaurants, it's the hospitality sector, grocery stores. I can go on and on. So when you add that all up, food has an enormous influence on our lives, personally, in terms of community, but also in terms of the economy. It doesn't just fuel our bodies, it fuels a whole lot more, including many, many jobs. But there is also a downside to food, or at least to the way we do food in the United States. Food appropriates 70% of our fresh water. Agriculture appropriates 70%, 70, of our fresh water. In the United States, almost 15% of greenhouse gas emissions stem from food transportation, because it turns out that California is our largest vegetable producers, and turns out Texas, as a matter of fact, is our largest meat producer. And both locations are far from the population centers on the East Coast. So our food travels enormous distances, and in doing so, it appropriates enormous amounts of natural resources that then also release CO2 and other emissions that contribute to our climate change, to air pollution, and so forth. In fact, worldwide, it's estimated that almost 25% of CO2 emissions stem from food transportation. And of course, in the United States, many of the foods that you and I may think of when we talk about food, namely vegetables and fruits, are really imported. They're not produced in the United States. In the United States, our agricultural system focuses largely on what the United States Department of Agriculture would call cash crops. That's corn, soybeans, grains. Some of them are not even used for food, but they are fuel, ethanol. Corn goes into ethanol production and certainly into animal feed. Our food system also has downside when it comes to human health. What I've just described to you, this food system where food is produced in very distant places, distant from where the consumers live, has health impacts as well. There is a lot of food loss in this transportation chain, but food also loses its nutrient density when it takes a long time between when we harvest it and when it actually ends up on our plates. Because if you spend a lot of time in transportation and storage, you can imagine that those tomatoes cannot possibly be harvested fully ripe, because otherwise they would arrive in our households as tomato sauce or something akin to that. So a lot of times our vegetables, our fruits are harvested a little bit earlier so they can endure this time it takes to get it to us as consumers. And so they're not harvested at nutrient peak. And you taste that difference when you have a tomato that was harvested early and then ripened, sometimes with the addition of other supplements to make it turn red a little bit more quickly. And you taste the difference between that and the tomato that you just picked out of your backyard. Food is also distributed unevenly. Some of our neighborhoods have full service grocery stores. Here in the District of Columbia, if you go to the northwest corner of the district, we have ample grocery stores, full service stores that sell fresh, unprocessed fruits and vegetables. And then you go to other parts of town, especially east of the Anacostia River in Ward 7 and 8 in the district, which is sort of divided into administrative areas that are called the wards. So the wards east of the river have very few grocery stores. Ward 7 and 8 have roughly one grocery store for 70,000 people. Now, that limits access to fresh, unprocessed food. And as a result, food access is very uneven. Some people have an easy time getting access to fresh, unprocessed food. For some people, it's very difficult. So food access is not only a matter of income, it is that too, because there are many households in the United States that simply don't have enough money to get food on the table for their families. But then there is another food access problem, namely not access to the right food, but to food that's highly processed. Many of our neighborhoods that don't have full service access to unprocessed food, food gets sold at the gas station. Well, that's not the kind of food you want to eat before you go to school. It's often full of sugar, fat, salt, not the kind of food content that makes for an active and healthy life and supports an active and healthy lifestyle. The USDA actually calls that food insecurity. And we have food insecurity on two counts, not enough food and not enough of the right food. And so we need to address that kind of food insecurity as part of our food system. The numbers are staggering. Here in the nation's capital, in Washington, D.C., over 30% of D.C. households with children say they were unable to afford either enough food or enough healthy food because healthy food is more costly. That's a staggering number. Over 30% of households with children in the nation's capital. And of course, you can imagine other parts of the country have similarly shocking numbers, particularly in the South. Now, COVID has put a bright spotlight on the issues with our food system because we learned about long supply chains that collapsed and we couldn't get for a while, we couldn't get pork and then we couldn't get some other things. And we learned that the food is processed in sometimes ways that we wouldn't support as consumers if we knew about it. We learned about massive COVID outbreaks in meatpacking plants. And we learned about massive COVID outbreaks among farm workers who come often from Central America and then work in conditions that we wouldn't be able to support. I certainly wouldn't as a consumer. If I knew how this food was produced, I would want to change it. Now, that's what is before us. So why is this happening? Why do we have a food system that is so highly centralized and that has social impacts and environmental impacts that are plainly negative? And those challenges will increase as we face a future by 2050, we are told that's not so far away, where we have to feed 10 billion people globally. So we need more food, but we also need better food, food that addresses the negative environmental impacts and the negative social impacts. So I would submit to you that a big part of this problem is that we think of food production, in fact, like everything else in the economy, we think of it very linearly. We say, okay, so we need inputs, we need fertilizer, we need water, we need machines, we need the seeds, we put them in the ground, and then we produce food, and then we put it somewhere. Well, wait a minute. That's not how nature works. And I just told you that food connects us to nature like maybe nothing else in our economy. But in fact, our whole economy doesn't work that way. In fact, it works as a cycle. We produce, we use the inputs to produce, but in the production process, there are already circular impacts. If the water that runs off the field still has too many nitrates in it, instead of those nitrates going into our food, they go into our water and they cause what's called eutrophication. They actually fertilize our surface waters. And so then we have algae growth and our fish die because they don't have enough oxygen and the whole rest of it. The same happens in the transportation, right? Transportation is not just bringing the food from the farm to the fork, but in the process of doing so, we create greenhouse gas emissions, we create CO2, we have other air pollutants that go into the cold chain. That's the technical term for food needs to be stored in cold spaces on the way. It uses up a lot of energy. And so there too is a cycle. And then there is a cycle when the food comes to us as consumers. Because if we simply put the leftover foods that we forgot about in the back of our refrigerator, right? If we put that down the garbage disposal, it creates problems in our water treatment plants. So why don't we collect it and turn it into compost? Because there is a way to close the cycle. Food can be used to create energy, to enhance soils. It can, in fact, be used to absorb CO2. Plants have the genius way of doing that. They actually take up the CO2 and breathe out oxygen. And we need that oxygen as people to breathe. And then we breathe out the CO2 that the green plants need. So This is a cycle, and we should really rethink the way, or we must rethink the way in which our economy works. Why does it work like a linear throughput system? Why does it not work like a cyclical system that closes the loop whenever possible? Because you see what food teaches us. Food is a resource, but food can also be a sink. In fact, these cycles of nature remind us that everything has a source and a sink. Now, what is a sink? Now, think about it. You have a sink in your bathroom and in your kitchen. What's the sink for? You put a cup under your faucet, the water runs over the top, and you need that sink to catch it. That's what sinks do. They catch the spillover. They catch the emissions, and they catch the waste. So environmental sinks, for example, are oceans. Turns out oceans absorb CO2. Soils also absorb carbon. They also happen to filter water. Plants absorb CO2. So there are a lot of ways in which the environment serves as a sink. But when we've overloaded our sinks, well, what happens if your sink gets overloaded in your kitchen and your bathroom? Oh, now it can't take up anymore. And if it can't take up anymore, eventually it spills over the edge and it makes a big mess on your bathroom floor and your kitchen floor. Well, that's about the point where we are right now with our environment. We have overloaded the sinks, and there are consequences. Turns out our bodies are sink too, because we take up pollutants, we take up the waste products that have been dispersed into our water and into our air. So our bodies are sinks. And we see that in some of our food desert neighborhoods and in the neighborhoods where we haven't paid attention to healthy green spaces. People get sick. And so we don't have to be surprised if we have very high levels of obesity, diabetes, hypertension in areas where we haven't paid attention to a healthy circular food system. Our bodies act as sinks for those negative side effects of an unhealthy food system. Oh, by the way, our family units can be sinks too, because if I'm really stressed, I'm going to take that stress home, and I require love and care and nurture. And if I don't get that love and care and nurture, you know what? I'm not going to show up very well at work tomorrow morning. And I'm not going to possibly be as productive as I could be if somebody had absorbed my stress and had helped me cope with it. So our communities are sinks. Our communities act as sinks for our stresses, for the disconnects in our lives, and for the traumas we experience in our lives. We rely on our communities to support us. We rely on friends. We rely on those we can identify with to learn, to enjoy, to share a meal. So we don't often think about those kinds of sinks that I call social sinks. So at the University of the District of Columbia, the only exclusively urban land grant in the United States, we set out to create a more circular food system. We just wanted to see if it can be done. And so we set out to create what we call our urban food hubs. And let me share a couple of pictures with you from our urban food hubs. Can you see that? This is a very different food system. We say, okay, this food system needs to be circular. So it needs to be about producing the food, and we do that in urban settings. So we do it very differently than you would see on large farms. So sometimes we don't use soil at all. Sometimes we use hydroponic and aquaponic systems to avoid areas where soil is polluted. And it turns out these high-tech ways of growing food vertically rather than horizontally in vertical systems, sometimes indoors, are pretty efficient ways of growing a lot of food in very small spaces. But then it's also about processing the food in healthy ways and using that opportunity of food preparation to also talk about healthy diets and good nutrition and age-appropriate diets, because what you need when you are a 17-year-old male, and believe me, I know this, I've raised three sons, they eat you out of house and home. And so their caloric needs are very different than mine as a 60-something-year-old woman, okay? So things change over time. And so what is a good diet, a healthy diet, changes too. And so in our food preparation efforts, we also need to pay attention to this very important teaching good and healthy eating habits. The third component of the urban food hubs is distribution. Food we are accustomed to buying in grocery stores. But of course, we've all seen the growth of farmers markets. And then there are CSAs, community supported agriculture, where you buy food, not by the pound, not in a store, but you get it delivered from a farm and either a pickup hub or or directly to your doorstep. But there are other distribution systems. Think about this. One of the genius ones, I think, that we've come up with here in Washington, D.C., is what's called veggie prescription. Instead of getting a prescription of medicine, some of our health providers give you a veggie prescription that is a coupon to a local farmer's market. So there are many different ways of distributing food that take a little bit creativity and thinking through of how can we improve access to healthy food. And last but not least, a really important component of this circular food system is waste and water recovery. So using as little water as possible. And these hydroponic and aquaponic systems that I've mentioned, they use only 10% of the water of conventional agriculture because the water is circulated. And some of them also use almost no fertilizer. The one you see up here in the upper left corner, that's part of an aquaponic system where you have fish tanks, and the fish excrement becomes the fertilizer for the plants. The plants take up the nutrients and the water cycles back into the fish tanks. And so it's a recirculating system that uses very little water and very little fertilizer. So we recover water wherever possible, but we also recover the food waste. Any food clippings during the food production process are composted, or they can be converted into energy through what's called biodigestion, where you create an anaerobic environment for the food waste to create energy. So we've been building this urban food system in Washington, D.C. This is a location in Ward 7. That was an early stage. If you go there now, it looks very, very different. It's actually a thriving community garden and a small greenhouse to start up plants in the spring. This is a food truck that helps with the second component of food preparation and sharing information about nutrition. These are just some pictures of our four food hubs located in Ward 7, Ward 8, Ward 5, and also on our main campus at Van Ness. That is not a food desert in Northwest in Ward 3. But we needed a demonstration site to also teach all these different ways of growing food and sharing food in community. So what have we learned from this work of building urban food systems right in our nation? Well, we've learned that we definitely need a different kind of food system across the country. We need a food system that is decentralized rather than highly centralized. A food system that has short supply chains. And if we ever needed to learn that lesson, COVID has taught us that lesson and continues to teach us that lesson, that particularly when it comes to food, which is a perishable product, we need to get back to producing it where most of the consumers live. And that includes our urban communities. We need a food system that is collaborative. That's my third point. So a decentralized one, one with short supply chain, and a collaborative one. What do I mean by that? I mean by that, that nobody in their right mind would suggest to you that we could grow all of our food for the United States food demand in urban areas. Can't be done. But what we can do is collaborate between urban areas, peri-urban areas around those densely populated cities and metro areas, and rural areas. And we can sit down together and figure out, oh, the most perishable products with the highest nutrient content, like your microgreens, your salads, and so forth, should be grown in urban centers. And the less perishable ones, like your beets and your peppers and so forth, they can be grown in a peri-urban ring. And that leaves plenty to do for the rural space where you can create, can grow the less perishable foods. And oftentimes these are also foods that are very heavy. So I would not recommend growing potatoes in the District of Columbia because they weigh a ton and they don't give you enough for your money. In terms of revenue. So you need to grow like basil and cilantro and microgreens in the urban core and leave a lot of food production for the rural space. But we also need to rethink our food system in terms of its decentralization and the need for decentralization, because I just told you at the outset that food connects us so much to our natural resources. And think what's happening on the West Coast of the United States. All up and down the West Coast, we have water problems. We have fires going on for months. And it happens to be that in those water scarce areas, we also grow most of our vegetables. So we have a lot of rethinking to do in terms of a collaborative food system where we grow what makes sense in the areas that can best support that kind of food system. So while we're at it, I'm going to add to that challenge, not only a circular food system, but a food system that starts to restore nature, a restorative food system, where we actually put carbon back in the soil, where we increase green cover so we absorb more of the CO2. So what kind of food system can we come up with that actually restores ecosystems services rather than undermining it? Now, that kind of food system would indeed be a food system that reconnects us to nature and actively uses our knowledge to create a food future that is shaped by how nature works rather than going against nature. Because I have news for you, nature will win that one. Thank you.